In the course of our ongoing discussion of the New City Catechism, we came this past week, Sunday, May the 12th, to question 28. What happens after death to those not united to Christ by faith? The answer provided by the New City Catechism: at the day of judgment, they will receive the fearful but just sentence of condemnation pronounced against them. They will be cast out from the favorable presence of God into hell, to be justly and grievously punished forever. While the Heidelberg and Westminster Shorter Catechisms, which were printed in the 17th century, focus on the positive side of avoiding eternal punishment, and they do that by emphasizing and making sure we understand what saving faith is all about, the New City Catechism has maintained an echo of the Westminster Larger Catechism by insisting that the eternal consequences of rejecting Christ should also be spelled out. Is hell for real? Is it really endless? Is it really necessary to insist that God intends its inhabitants to suffer conscious torment? Is the concept of hell even just? In our time, of course, the subject of hell is broadly considered to be something that's just mythical or perhaps at best ethically motivational. It's not a topic we want to spend much time thinking about. In that regard, however, we're deeply out of step with every other century of the Church's history. In 1880, the famous French sculptor Auguste Rodin, born 1840, died 1917, was commissioned to create a pair of bronze doors that would provide entrance to a newly planned museum of decorative arts in Paris. Unfortunately, the museum was never completed and the artist stopped working on the project. He wanted to capitalize on some of the work that he had done for it, however, and so he released, in isolation, a few of the scenes and characters that he had created. One of those most famous of Rodin's sculptures came out of that and has been known as the Thinker. Caught in a moment of intense contemplation, Rodin sculpted a man sitting with his fist in his hand and his eyes staring downward. The Thinker has often been associated with the philosophical foundationalism of the much earlier Frenchman, the philosopher René Descartes, born 1596, died 1650. The ground of all reality, Descartes had famously announced, is to be found in the simple statement, e cogito ergo sum, in Latin, or in English, I think, therefore I am. The Cartesian Thinker has come to represent the manifesto of the Enlightenment and even of our late modern humanism. In point of fact, however, the Thinker was originally called the Poet. Rodin had placed him at the pinnacle of the doorway to the museum, the tympanum. Rodin was not representing Descartes, but Dante, whose epic poem entitled The Divine Comedy, and particularly its initial vision of hell entitled The Inferno, captured something of the most astounding vision the Thinker finds himself to contemplate. Rodin's Poet is frozen in the anguished act of contemplating the horrors of hell. As we gathered, we find ourselves having to take a similar pose. We attempted to think seriously about the staggering concept of eternal torment, the meaning and justice of an all-wise, benevolent, but breathtakingly holy God dealing with the consequences of our humanness, our sinfulness, our imperfections. It was, as I suppose it ought to be, an exhausting and deeply sobering experience. We considered some of the many interpretive theories that have been adopted in the long history of the Church's engagement with the doctrine of hell. From the attempts to appropriate classical philosophy, Platonism and Neoplatonism, by which a view of immortality is created that applies to the soul but not to a material or bodily existence. We talked about the Catholic and Anglo-Catholic view of hell as an interim process of moral refinement and further probation. And we talked about the increasingly more popular views of our time that emphasize final soul sleep and annihilationism. In all, we sought to deepen our appreciation for the rich complexity of interpretations surrounding the Christian conception of hell. Turning then specifically to the Bible, we read as carefully and intentionally as we could from just two of the many important passages, John chapter 3, verses 16 to 21, and Matthew chapter 25, verses 1 to 46. It might be good for you to pause the recording at this point and to read those passages, John 3, 16 to 21, Matthew 25, 1 to 46. We tried to draw out a number of the foundational observations that come from these texts. Among these, we noted from John chapter 3 that condemnation before God is the default setting of human existence. We stand condemned already if we don't come to faith. That, number two, God's remarkable and entirely unmerited provision of a means of salvation, which cost him the giving up of his only begotten Son, constitutes an act of pure love, of unmerited grace on his part, for the restoration of his creation, the cosmos, and of the reinstatement of his intended goodness for the creation, measured, of course, according to his standards. Thirdly, the complexity encountered in the atonement, which required the incarnation, crucifixion, resurrection, and ascension of God the Son, itself reflects something of the seriousness with which God treats the eternal condemnation of his human creatures. Fourthly, we observe that without faith in the fact and the sufficiency of God's provision in the gift of his Son, condemnation prevails and is based on the entirely unnatural and irrational reality that being human has come to mean that we prefer darkness to light. The fact that God is light, and that light in John's biblical writings, the Gospels and the Epistles, appears to mean something like moral or personal conformity to truth. This fact grounds the biblical fact of God's absolute intolerance of a human preference for darkness. It's inconceivable that his human creatures would prefer darkness to light, morally speaking. Fifthly, we observe that John's gospel also attempts to explain our intolerable preferential option for darkness on the basis that moral clarity exposes our otherwise, so we think, justifiable weaknesses for the truly culpable chain of God-resistant choices that they really are. Turning to Matthew 25, which strings together three important parables, all of which build towards the biblical understanding of the justice of eternal conscious torment. We observed there, first of all, that the real basis of final failure to enter into the eternal presence of God has to do with our present failure to genuinely prefer the happiness of God over our own self-interests. Those preparing for the appearance of the bridegroom didn't bother to prepare well enough to ensure that they stayed with the bride right up to the place of entering into the celebration. Secondly, we observe that our failure to live lives that are productive of God's glory is rooted in a deeply twisted conception of God's character and of God's prerogatives with respect to the absolute gift nature of our human existence. All of life is a gift, but we constantly err by presuming it to be an inherent or inalienable right. Thirdly, we observe that God's determination of our eternal destiny is, as it ought to be, rooted in his determination of love and loyalty to the glory of his only begotten Son. Growing out of this brief survey of lessons to be learned from the study of both historical and biblical theological perspectives, I want to suggest the following brief summary of doctrinal principles regarding eternal conscious torment. First of all, that because God creates with purpose, his creation is oriented toward completion or fulfillment of his intentions for it. And secondly, the purpose toward which all creatures are directed is rooted in the perfection of God's own character. Thirdly, then, that as human creatures, our existence is particularly theological, in that our being and our telos, or intended completion, fits uniquely within the material world designed to manifest God's spiritual image. Fourthly, that like God, we subsist proportionately, of course, not absolutely as he does, but we subsist as simple but complex beings. We are material spiritual, or embodied souls, and we cannot realize our potential so long as, on the one hand, the material aspect dominates, so that our souls are put down and we become essentially carnal, or, on the other hand, our intended potential cannot be realized in a bodiless, intermediate, or purely spiritual state. It is God's purpose that redeemed human souls exist in conjunction with transformed or spiritual bodies. Bodily spirits is the essence of humanity. Fifthly, the unique dignity that comes with this unique unity and complexity of body and spirit provides or constitutes a unique responsibility. As C.S. Lewis famously explains in his essay entitled The Weight of Glory, human beings are creatures designed with the incredible potential of becoming either progressively more like God, so he says creatures of infinite beauty, or progressively less like God, creatures that are monstrous. Sixthly, eternal existence, which appears to be a necessary consequence of being made in God's image, dictates that we, human beings, who do not realize the intended purpose of joyful, progressive, and proportionate, again, never absolute, conformity to the perfection of God's character, must progress in the opposite direction toward a just experience of the negation of God's character, but a negation that is enduring. Seventh, the outer darkness and eternal fire descriptions of hell, which Jesus uses most frequently, are in one sense opposites. That is to say, fire is the primary source of light, and at the same time, darkness is the absence of fire. But these expressions, more fully understood, are intended to represent the experience of God's good creation without the experience of its intended goodness, and therefore with nothing but its most destructive and negative consequences, fire that burns without creating light, darkness that exists in spite of the presence of flame. Eighthly, the consequence of persistence in the rebel state of condemnation, despite the free grace of forgiveness and reconciliation that is provided by God in Jesus Christ, is eternal separation from God and from good. Like all theological truths, mere human language and experience is strained beyond its capacity to convey the full meaning of the destiny of a human soul. And so we came on Sunday to the end of a very lengthy and exhausting discussion of eternal human destiny. We returned to thoughts of Rodin's image of the thinker. Ever since Descartes' turn to the human subject, modern and late modern humanity has been traveling on a pronounced trajectory away from that of Rodin's poet. Viewed from within our approach to these biblical teaching, it seems highly likely, therefore, that our late modern reticence to think deeply and seriously about the justice of God in the eternal conscious torment of a godless soul is symptomatic of our rebellious human propensity toward the moral darkness of self-reliance rather than towards the intended moral light of absolute love for and dependence upon the perfection of God. Rodin's poet is obviously deep in thought. but it's striking to note that his right elbow rests on his left knee in a way that conveys a deep and uncomfortable inner tension. The information exceeds his capacity to explain and leaves him deeply perplexed. Taken out of its original context, Rodin's thinker conveys the struggle of deriving all necessary forms of human knowledge from within the self-contained human mind. It seems to promise an equally rewarding outcome. That's Descartes' conception. But unlike the thinker, Rodin's poet has a much greater chance of grasping the eternal significance of salvation in Jesus Christ, because Rodin's poet has taken the time to agonize with truths conveyed from God that exceed our capacity to understand. And for this reason, the biblical revelation asks us to think as often and as deeply about the doctrine of eternal torment and the justice of God, as well as of the doctrine of eternal blessedness and the compassion of God, because God exceeds our capacity to understand. But all that he has revealed to us is there for us to learn and to grow. There is an invitation to eternal life, and there is a reality of eternal separation from God, and we are called upon to contemplate them both, though acknowledging we cannot begin to grasp either. Nevertheless, the exercise enlarges our souls, and we look to God to continue that process from day to day in our lives.